Okay, my turn. Good morning. Thomas Kummerow appearing on behalf of Lori Lloyd, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Before I get into the meat of the argument here, I did want to make just a comment about the court's plan to issue two different opinions.
Yes.
And we do have this procedural aspect that we can take a benefit of adopting each other's arguments. Mm-hmm. And one of the benefits of that is looking down the road for federal habeas.
Well, we can reference that in both the opinions.
Because
I'm
troubled somewhat by the fact that the opinion doesn't address the issue. It just footnotes, and you may have
questions. Don't address it in your brief, so can simply say
exactly.
You filed a notice that adopted the arguments in the Link case.
Yeah, I have no idea how that'll play out on federal habeas. I'm just thinking.
I think it would incorporate the same arguments.
We'll see. I want to focus my argument this morning on a single issue, and that's the question of the sufficiency of the evidence as far as criminal or the assault in the first degree, assault of a child in the first degree. And the issue here is the interplay between the actions of Ms. Lloyd, the actions of Mr. Sefton, and the case of State versus Jackson, which talks about accomplice liability. Because remember, the major actor in the assaults was Mr. Sefton. It wasn't Ms. Lloyd. Ms. Lloyd is pretty much limited to swatting him with the spoon and pulling on the ear. And pulling on the ear was a major event, but that's the only event that she's implicated in. The rest of it is Mr. Sefton. So it has to be a question of accomplice liability. Jackson is important because Jackson talks about omission to act, a failure to act. Failure to act is not a crime in the state of Washington unless the statute makes it a crime. And criminal mistreatment happens to be one of those statutes. But Jackson says omission to act is not an offense. And what we've got here is pretty much an argument that Ms. Sefton or Ms. Lloyd is not acting to take care of Kyron, to protect Kyron from Mr. Sefton's assaults. And under Jackson, that would make her innocent, or at least not guilty. It's an interplay between the two, which is very, very interesting. And from our standpoint, her actions are not enough to rise to the level of an assault of a child in the first degree, and the accomplice liability doesn't allow her to be held liable for it. And it's interesting that the state and our double jeopardy argument talk about limiting the evidence, the assaults, or the aspect of the assault of a child in the first degree. The food issues go to the criminal mistreatment. So we're only talking about the assaults. And the assaults, I keep saying, were done by Mr. Sefton. Ms. Lloyd was very limited in what she did. And so it's got to be accomplice liability. And argument is, it was simply a failure to act on her part, a failure to protect Kyron. And so that's the essence of the argument here. I don't have a whole lot to say on the other issues. They're pretty basic. I mean, the IAC for the same criminal conduct, they are the same.
Otherwise known as ineffective assistance to counsel.
There you go. Sorry, that's my shorthand. The assault of a child and criminal mistreatment, certainly they were the same time, same place. And there was same intent. It was discipline. It was this misguided form of discipline. And the double jeopardy is defenses as charged and proved. It was the exact same evidence. So unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
James Wiston again, representing the state.
Before you start, do you have concerns about the proposed approach to these two cases and the opinions that are going to be written?
You can do it either way.
Okay.
I don't have a preference.
All right. Mr. Kummerow, I think you've got 7 minutes left by my calculation. So you'll have the last word.
Thank you.
Well, it sounds, Your Honor, like we're focusing on the sufficiency of the evidence to prove that Ms. Lloyd participated in these insults, so I'll do that.
And in addition to that, can you also briefly address the same criminal conduct ineffective assistance to counsel argument? But go ahead.
Okay. there are a lot of issues here. As to the sufficiency of the evidence, of course, I just want to start with a quick reminder to the standard I'm sure you're very familiar with, and that is that, you know, all presumptions are to be drawn in the light most favorable of non-moving party, et cetera. If you look at the testimony, the most significant, I think, the most succinct place, simplest place you can find testimony showing Ms. Lloyd's involvement is in the testimony of her daughter, R.L. R.L. testified that, in general, she testified that Lloyd had a large role in spanking both she and her brother, that she used some wooden thing, which I don't think was defined much beyond that, but the victim here, K.S., had linear bruising across his buttocks, for example. He had bruising to his lower back. So that is consistent with somebody who's striking him using an implement. She also, she being the daughter, testified quite clearly that both Sefton and Lloyd took hold of the victim's ear and walked him around, you know, pulling on his ear as he was screaming. Both of them did that. And that was the incident, that was the mechanism that gave rise to this injury that was noticed at the end of February, February 26th, by the school counselor. And then there was the bruising from that injury continued all the way into the following week in early March when he was examined. And I think it was Dr. Wiester who testified that that injury alone was diagnostic of abuse. There's no other mechanism that would account for such a severe bruising of the ear. So what we have then is direct testimony from the daughter describing the mother's involvement in the infliction of that particular injury and the daughter's testimony about the more general assaults that she also participated in, assaults that I guess Lloyd and Sefton both considered to be simple parental discipline.
So how do you characterize the ongoing food regimen?
Well, that goes to the criminal mistreatment charge. The deprivation of food is relevant to that charge, not to the assault of a child charge. And so for purposes of this particular argument, I don't think that that makes a difference. But in general, there was evidence that both Lloyd and Sefton participated in the deprivation of food. In fact, it seems that she was as much the driving force in that course of conduct as was Sefton.
But I mean, counsel's argument was she didn't have a duty. She didn't violate a duty.
She certainly had a duty.
The parent.
She certainly had a duty to feed him. And but if you go now, we're switching back, I assume, to the assault. She certainly had a duty to refrain from, you know, picking him up by his ear and dragging and walking around in circles, as was described, in a way that resulted in those sorts of bruises. So, you know, you have testimony of this child having all sorts of injuries over a long period of time. You have testimony of a
but are those injuries? I mean, going back to your previous argument, mm-hmm. are those injuries? And you said you could characterize as continuing course of conduct.
Mm-hmm.
Are those the injuries that occurred in the February time period?
Well, you have both. You have testimony about lower level assaults that have occurred for a long period of time, or at least that are indefinite as to when they occurred. And then you have the testimony of the three assaults that resulted in the ear, the mouth, and the burning of the hands, which was attributed to plunging his hands in hot water. The victim himself said that. I believe it was to the forensic interviewer. So,
and where who gave testimony about the low-level assaults?
I'm sorry, I keep trying to use his first name. K.S., the victim, did, in talking to the forensic interviewer and describing the fact that he was assaulted, by both his parents over a long period of time, but particular to those three incidents. As I say, you have the testimony of the daughter saying very clearly that she's the one that they both were picking him up and walking around in circles
by
his
ear. So are
those
the more dramatic? Or?
Yes. And those are the ones that occurred during that approximately 20-day period at the end of February and into March, where, as I said, it appears that things had escalated to the point where authorities were starting to be on these parents and were it appeared that their luck was running out, basically, and they were going to be exposed. And that's when the severity of the assaults ramped up. So I think that you know, if you apply the sufficiency of the evidence standard to that very, very clear testimony from the daughter, and also from testimony from a number of other sources that testified to, well, for example, the maintenance man who came in and said, you know, I saw the dad, you know, take the child out. Well, I guess that goes to the dad, not specifically to the mom. But there are other instances where witnesses were testifying to a course of a bruising, and then you have the victim and you have the daughter testifying to the fact that both parents were imposing physical discipline on this child.
Back to Judge Applewick's question, though, they weren't married, and so she's not the mom.
Yes.
She's not the stepmom. What is Ms. Lloyd, and where does that duty come from?
Well, she would need a duty only if we were charging her on a failure to act theory, and we weren't. We were arguing that she was participating in this course of conduct. She was participating in these assaults.
So it is an accomplice liability theory?
It would be. I mean, she was clearly acting as an accomplice as to many of the other things that were going on, and particularly she was both an accomplice and a principal as to withholding food. I think, you know, there was evidence that she was participating in these physical assaults, and so she too is a principal. And it's impossible to unpack exactly how much either one of them participated, of course. But we're arguing that she's a principal as to both. We're not depending on a theory that she was an accomplice and then therefore needed some sort of special relationship, duty to act. That would be more like the Jackson situation. I didn't go into a tremendous amount of detail on that in the briefing and really hadn't thought about it that much before today because I don't think it was so much presented in that same way. But in any event, we're relying on the fact that she was a principal. She was actively participating in the physical assaults.
Same criminal conduct?
Thank you. Is there a particular aspect of that, Your Honor? We only have 2 minutes.
Well, the argument is that counsel was ineffective for failing to make the argument of same criminal conduct. So then we, and the argument is, well, related to the age of the child and focused only on the age of the child, I think.
Yeah, I don't recall exactly how the argument is made. I believe that our argument was that these were not the same course of criminal conduct because you don't have, as to the two separate crimes, criminal mistreatment and assault, you don't have the same objective criminal purpose, which is what the test is as the same criminal conduct. So it's not just that they have the same intent. It's not a double jeopardy argument where you're looking at the elements per se. You're looking at the overarching scheme. Now, in one sense, one could say that these two people appear to have had, you know, some overarching purpose to make this child's life miserable. But I don't think that you have to go to that level of generality. I think what the case law talks about is, like I say, objective criminal purpose. In other words, that one crime is not merely furthering the other. And I think that although these two, this course of conduct they were involved in, had two aspects to it, it did have two aspects. One was to deprive this child of food, and the other was this ongoing pattern of low-level assaults that then escalated towards the end of the period. And I think that's sufficient, especially, usually this would be reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard, and it would be sufficient to conclude that the judge didn't abuse his discretion in deciding that these were not the same objective criminal purpose. The judge sat on this entire trial. Now, of course, it wasn't placed directly in front of him because the issue wasn't raised.
Right.
But I think that you could, at least by inference, conclude that he didn't believe it was the same criminal conduct and scored them separately.
All right.
Thank you.
Very briefly about the same criminal conduct. We are talking about the same intent here. And it is an overall objective intent. And the intent here was some sort of misguided, weird attempt at parenting that just got out of hand. That's the only way you can explain it. That essentially was the overarching intent. So it was the same time and place. It was the same intent. If counsel had made the argument, seemingly the judge would have or should have found the offenses to be the same criminal conduct.
Are you saying the withholding of food was the equivalent of causing pain or agony, equivalent to torture? Is that the argument you're
making? No. That would be double jeopardy if I was making that argument. No, I'm making the same criminal conduct argument where...
Same time
and place. Same time and place and same intent. And the intent is not the same element of intent. It's an overarching objective standard of what was their intent in conducting these two offenses. If you look at the testimony of KS, he's very clear about the majority of the assaults, the striking, the cold showers, the push-ups. All of that type of behavior is done by Mr. Sefton. It's not done by Ms. Lloyd. Ms. Lloyd uses whatever this little wooden implement is to strike him occasionally and does the ear pulling. But the ear pulling is sort of a transient, minor injury. I mean, it's not a permanent injury. It goes away. It's a transient pain. That doesn't rise to the level of assault of a child in the first degree. So
you're arguing there's no substantial bodily harm from the physical assault?
What I'm arguing is, yes, A, and B, yes, from her standpoint as a principal, yes. And then B, if she's going to be held to an accomplice standard and be found guilty of that as an accomplice, you have to take Jackson into consideration and say, is she an accomplice or is she just failing to act? Since she isn't the mother, she's just a girlfriend and has no relationship to this child.
Well, she has a relationship. I'm just not sure what it is.
Yes, and it's not a legal relationship of any kind, so it doesn't require her to act. And there's no statutory duty under the assault of the child statute for her to act.
But if the children...
Under treatment, there might be. In fact, there is. But under assault of a child, there isn't.
Doesn't the record support that at times she was in physical care and control of the child and responsible for feeding?
For criminal mistreatment, yes, because remember the state says the physical injuries go to the assault of a child, the food issues go to the criminal mistreatment, and we're not challenging the sufficiency of the criminal mistreatment. We're only challenging the sufficiency of the assault of the child. So unless the court has any other questions, I would just ask this court to reverse Ms. Lloyd's convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you.